Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore, and in this episode, I'll be joined by some of our healthcare experts at BSA to talk about oncology design and all the thought that goes into designing spaces that care for and treat those affected with and by cancer. Our guests on this episode are Doug Abrams, Christy Adams, and Terry Joy. Doug Abrams is a senior healthcare planner at BSA and has been with the firm for 30 years. A graduate of Ball State University, Doug has a BS in architecture, energy-conscious design, and environmental design. He's also ACA certified. Doug is based out of our Indianapolis studio. Christy Adams is our National Director of Planning and is part of the AIA and is EDAC certified. Christy graduated from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro with a BSN in interior design, and she earned her Master's of Architecture from NC State. Terry Joy is our National Director of Ops Planning and has been a guest on this podcast previously, including Episode 8, where we discussed the importance of master planning. A graduate of Indiana State University, Terry has certifications in EDAC, CEN, TCRN, and has spent over 30 years as a registered nurse in clinical operations and leadership in Eskenazi Health and Union Hospital. At Eskenazi, Terry was the Director of Trauma Services, Perioperative Services, Orthopedic Services, and Clinical Education. She served as an education board member for the Nursing Institute for Healthcare Design for 3 years. Welcome to the show, everybody. So glad you're joining us today. Terry, I know we've had the pleasure of talking with you before on BSA by Design, but Doug and Christy, this is your guys' first time. So I always like to start out with the traditional opening question. Can you share where your passion for architecture and design came from? And Christy, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm going to tell you it's a loaded question because it goes back many years to my earliest memories. In a hospital or in a car on the way to the hospital, my dad was diagnosed with cancer when I was just a few months old. And so all of those earliest memories in dark waiting rooms, giant TVs hanging from the ceiling and narrow hallways, all of those experiences kind of helped me understand that where our most pivotal and formative moments happen, especially in my lifetime, my dad's lifetime, they're in a hospital or in a healthcare setting. And so I don't have the disposition to be a nurse or a practitioner, but I'm playing my part by creating the backdrop for those experiences to happen. And just to add one more thing, my dad had a cancer journey. My son is a childhood cancer survivor, and I'm really happy to be here today talking about oncology facilities. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Doug, how about yourself?
Well, my grandfather was a stonemason, and he not only built these beautiful homes, but he designed them as well. And so that started an interest. And then in high school, I went to a really small high school. And our only books on architecture was on Frank Lloyd Wright. So I think I had those books checked out the entire 4 years I was there, and I was hooked. And I naively thought that all architects were like Frank Lloyd Wright. You know, they were geniuses. And so I'm no genius, but since I started working at BSA, I just really found comfort. I just find it rewarding to work on healthcare spaces, and especially I'm a cancer survivor myself, and especially working on cancer centers. And it's thinking about that family and patient and staff experience, and then thinking that, you know, I can contribute somewhat to that experience and help along that healing journey. It's just really rewarding.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's a whole lot of people left in the world that probably haven't been touched by cancer at some point, whether it's themselves or, you know, like you said, a family member. My mother-in-law passed away about 10 years ago from cancer. And it's one of the reasons when I was looking at BSA mission and what we're trying to do with our design spaces speaks so much. So I'm hopeful that what comes out of this is just how much we really care about things. And obviously, we wanted to have you all on the show to talk about oncology and cancer care. Let's start with master planning. So, Doug, how do you approach the integration of cancer centers within the larger healthcare campus?
Well, we really think about convenience for the patient. And think about wayfinding, make that intuitive, and they can find their way to the cancer center. And the cancer center usually wants to have its own identity. So it becomes a destination for the patient. And, you know, we think about convenience of parking so they don't have to walk long distances. And but then branding is important, too. So they're still, you know, associated with the main campus.
That makes a lot of sense. And what role does outpatient care play in a modern oncology facility planning?
Yeah, I think it's all about access to care. I mentioned that I was a cancer survivor. I live like an hour away from the city, but my hematologist is just 5 minutes away, and he's associated with a major academic medical center. And so having that outpatient center nearby is just critical for me. It's just really important.
Yeah, you make a really good point about that. I mean, the fact that your hematologist is only 5 minutes away, even though you live a little farther from, like, let's say, a major metropolitan area, when you're dealing with something such as cancer, it can be tiring and exhausting. So I'm sure that's a very large consideration that you have to make.
Yeah, and it's not only for the patient, but it's for that support member, that family member as well. You know, they often travel with the patient and so forth. So it's convenient for them.
That's a really good point. So let's talk a little bit about the technical design challenges. What are the unique infrastructure requirements for different cancer treatment modalities like radiation, chemotherapy, immunotherapy?
Well, it really the radiation therapy requires a lot of heavy shielding. And in the past, that meant that those were located oftentimes below grade. And so that created really dark environments, and it wasn't really very pleasant for the cancer patient. Fortunately, those have become, they've seen the light of day, so to speak, and they've come out of the ground, but they're still somewhat confined to grade level. Just due to the weight of the shielding, you might have concrete thicknesses up to 8 foot thick walls. So that's one consideration. Another consideration is how to classify the building, whether it's classified as a hospital or classified as a medical office building. That has implications on the structure and infrastructure and MEP as well.
That's a good point. Christy, let me get you involved in the conversation a little bit. How do you future-proof oncology facilities for emerging technologies and some of the treatment methods? How do you plan for growth and evolution in cancer care services?
So we begin that conversation early, immediately in pre-design and programming. We work through different scenarios with the client and ask them to look at what 3 years brings to them and 5 years and then even 10-year projections and understand their care model, those volume projections, and then compare that all to the project budget, the schedule, and put together a growth strategy with the client to really understand how fast do they anticipate growing, what service lines do they anticipate growing. From a basic planning perspective, we look at how to organize spaces to allow corridors to extend. You know, that's the simplest thing. Just allow the building to continue to stretch out if it works that way. But planning in repeatable modules that can easily be repurposed and reconfigured pretty easily to combine spaces and allow in-place conversions. If we have a great project budget and we have some serious growth projections, we can look at vertical expansion, adding an elevator shaft for future expansion, and then all of the infrastructure spaces like the electrical rooms, mechanical rooms, try to add space in there so that they can accept the additional capacity for the growth.
Yeah, well, we'll look at, you know, how those, like, each department might grow in the footprint, and we can provide soft space next to a department that's going to grow. That's like office space with minimal plumbing or a meeting room that could be easily renovated if an adjacent department wants to grow into that space. And we can provide shell space if the budget allows, so that we build a shell for a space, a department can grow into that space without having to add on. And of course, we plan for vertical or horizontal expansion or both as potential opportunities. And especially important is that LINAC. We always plan for a second or third LINAC and how that can position on the site, keep utilities away from that area, and then position that so it's in the right place and it can share shielding. One important consideration is we try to allow each department to grow in place so that, say, one department's not landlocked and can't grow and might have to be completely relocated. That's an option, but if we can make each department, if we can allow it to grow in place, then that helps down the road.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense too. Doug, let's stay with you. Are there any innovations in cancer care delivery that have most significantly impacted facility design in recent years?
Well, I mean, we've seen that like, technology has really progressed, and say linear accelerators have gotten a lot more precise. And so that's reduced some of the needs, like say for a mold room, and it also reduces the amount of treatment time so they can see more patients per day.
TJ, I haven't gotten you involved in the conversation. So I've heard about this term bench to bed. Can you kind of explain what that means?
I think as cancer care is progressing, it's become much more specific to the individual, to the cell, to some of the body's makeup. And researchers have been able to provide a much more targeted approach, which is coming much more to the forefront. And what you have in large academic centers or in research centers is you have physicians that are doing both. They're actually doing the research and they're actually caring for the patients. The patients are in research studies. And so the bench to bed allows for the provider to do both parts of their job in a smaller space, and they don't have to go all the way across campus. So thinking about if they had a research lab, where is that adjacency to actually caring for the patients? And then a lot of times the patients will follow up in a research clinic for additional testing, or will follow up with those physicians for testing. And so just trying to understand what those needs are as cancer care progresses, because there's a lot of research being done currently in that realm.
Well, and I know you've planned several of these spaces, of course. I just wanted you to discuss also the integration of the clinical support services, you know, the pharmacy, the imaging, the labs that are in cancer center design.
I think that Christy and Doug's expertise, they hit on it about convenience and wayfinding for the patient. And I always try to think of that as part of that convenience is, does the team that's caring for the patient, can they do what they need to do in a fairly quick, efficient manner and have everything they need in that area? So when you come in for a treatment, you may need your labs drawn pre-treatment, you may need drugs created. So pharmacy, lab, understanding where imaging is, so that you're really minimizing the amount of time so that that patient can get to where they need to go for that treatment, but then also allowing that team of providers that's caring for that individual to understand, hey, our workspace is great and we are seeing a lot of people and we can be efficient and we can be less stressed caring for them. Because everyone feels very passionately about caring for patients. I think cancer patients, just as you said earlier, Brian, everyone has experienced someone with cancer. And so sometimes that anxiety level and that I want to say that you really want to make an impact. So you want to make sure you're efficient. So thinking about pharmacy, lab, social work, some of those ancillary services that might need to wrap around that patient, that's really important when you're designing.
I want to lean in on that. So it's about that time spent going between all those different departments, but it's also about decreasing the exposure of the patient and making sure that they feel physically and psychologically safe as they go between those spaces, because they already feel like they're the germ magnet. So we try to really intentionally lessen
that. That's a really good point. Yeah, they're already concerned about so many other things, probably, that some of the stuff that you're talking about just makes it easier on them, right?
We think about really the patient journey through the facility and talking about patient wait times. You know, they'll have to, they get labs drawn and then they have to wait for results for, say, for the chemo to be prescribed and made so they can be treated. And so oftentimes we'll locate that lab like near the front entry. So that's the first place they go to. And we try to provide them sub-waiting spaces and just think about their journey, you know, between those different spots. And so that way their labs can be analyzed like while they're traveling up and checking in to infusion. And then it's important that we place out pharmacy, you know, convenient to those infusion bays, just to reduce the amount of time that staff is traveling back and forth and trying to reduce the amount of wait time for the patient.
Yeah. And then sticking with those supportive services, which ones are the most critical to success for oncology?
Well, and I can give an answer, and then I'd like, you know, Christy and Doug, please chime in, because I think you have a lot of good. I mean, I think that the services. So you have the clinical services that Doug was talking about, like the person's there for the care today. They're there for a treatment. We want to get that done. We want to get that done in an efficient manner and be supportive and limit exposure, like Christy was talking about, and also allow the staff to interact with the patients. The staff become very part of these patients' journey as well, because they see them on a regular basis. If you see patients on a regular basis, you develop rapport with them. And so people are very, you know, they want to make sure that they're delivering that service. It's like caring for your family almost. You see them, here they are again today. How are you feeling? So there's that interaction. I think the other piece that is critical to this is the wraparound coordination of care services. I haven't talked a lot about my personal experience with cancer. My mom died of cancer, lung cancer, in 2014. And I'm a nurse, and I'm a pretty savvy nurse at that. And trying to coordinate her care and try to care for her at home and trying to get my dad to be able to do it, he just was not able to do it. But I can't imagine what that would be like if you didn't have some services. I had a great coordinator. There was a care coordinator. There was a social worker that was assigned. She had a clinical pharmacist. She had a clinical nurse practitioner that worked with the doctor. There were like all these people that you had access to. I knew who to call. But if you don't know who to call, you really need that care navigator. So you need one person that you can say, this is the problem. And a lot of times those care navigators are in the cancer center, so that you can check in and figure out like what coordinating insurance coverage of home oxygen. You wouldn't think that that is a big to do. It's a huge to do. And understanding that what these people really need, instead of just, oh, we're going to care for you at home, just supporting that and having that wraparound coordination. A lot of places call them care navigators, or they'll call them cancer coordinators. Those are really your go-to people. And having space for them to be able to interact with patients in the site, but also to take phone calls and maybe do telehealth from home so that they can do those things. They really are that kind of, that's the portal into where can I get help and how do I keep getting those services. So if you really thinking of spaces like that, pharmacists are very important. Clinical pharmacists will do a lot of counseling with these patients. Making sure you have private spaces to have those conversations, I think, is really important.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point from the standpoint of whether it's the patients or the family members, they've got enough plates spinning and there's enough going on that, you know, having to deal with multiple people is just another thing that adds pressure and stress to them. Doug, Christy?
Yeah, I think providing this flexible spaces for different therapies, whether it's counseling or yoga, massage therapy, those kind of spaces, maybe a meditation space, just to address the emotional well-being of the patient, the family member, and the staff, you know, really goes a long way. And providing some kind of resources for education is important. And multi-purpose spaces, like I say, flexible spaces, just to accommodate like different sizes of groups. More intimate spaces and then larger spaces for larger groups as well.
That's also a really good point as I'm thinking about it. You know, you've got, especially if you're a family member, we're all different types of people, right? So there's some folks that are like, give me all the research on this that I can get my hands on. I want to understand it. And you've got probably other folks who are like, I need to breathe for a minute. I need a place of solace. So that's a really good point.
That's very important. Yeah,
the reference libraries are a big deal, and making sure that they're easily accessible and along the path to the clinics. And that's really what you try to do when you're looking at patient support and patient amenities. Never call them amenities, but they're really part of providing attention to the health of the whole person. So the emotional side of the cancer journey is really, really hard. And it's not just hard for the patient, the family. You got to think about the staff too. So in the things that we provide or the questions that we ask, it's always, how can we add something to the environment that supports the full care team, including the family members? Things like gift shops. They're fun. It's a good diversion. It's support also, though, because they typically have wig shop inside them. They provide fittings, and they do that in a discreet, respectful environment. They sell hats that you may not be able just to go and find on a regular shelf. And then the support groups, which is what Doug was talking about. If I take it from like the parent of the cancer kid, having a play space, you cannot imagine just what a small playroom or a small rooftop play area can really add to that. Because you're going multiple times a week. When I was going, I was taking not only my sick child, but my twins who were, they were in clinic with us from the time right. they were a week old. And so making sure that you're looking at all of the different scenarios and trying to provide not only opportunities for healing, but normalcy, normalcy.
Yeah, those treatment times, those infusions can last, 4 to 6 hours. So providing that family space, that family retreat space is really important.
Yeah, if you don't have those, Doug, that's a good point. If they're lasting that long, it makes that clock go a lot slower if you don't have something to occupy your mind, your body,
And it even goes down to, how you provide for nourishment for everyone involved. So there's a lot of detail that goes into that as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Terry, I want to talk about your clinical workflow, or not yours, but about clinical workflow and staff considerations in these spaces. And as you said, your background as a nurse, what are those critical workflow elements that you need to consider?
Well, I think they're similar to outpatient. You want to have what you need to take care of a patient within 80 to 100 feet of where you're going. You want to have stuff in the room. You want to have items available. So you really want to think through that workflow. I think we've touched on this a couple of times. Like scenario testing is important when you're designing these environments. Like what is the patient and family going to experience during the visit? And then really trying to parallel that with what is the clinician or the physician or the pharmacist or people that are interacting, what do they need along that? And then trying to make sure those things are congruent with each other. And I think that just trying to overlay those scenarios and doing some of that scenario testing helps with that clinical efficiency and workflow. Remember that supplies need to be delivered as well. Medications need to be delivered. There's a lot of technology now that goes into giving medications and for safety reasons. And so just making sure that that is streamlined, that the patient and family still feel like it's humanistic care and that you don't lose the human touch with all of the innovation's great, but there's still a human involved and that connection I think is still important. So just allowing time and space for that plus all the other things you need, you really have to carefully plan for that.
Yeah, a robot's not going to be able to give that compassion right. that a human being can for
here's
sure
here's your chemo, but still and making sure that component's still available.
And Doug, I know we kind of touched on a little bit of this whole approach. You're designing spaces not only for families and patients, but also the healthcare staff. So what are those spaces? How do you design those spaces that support the technical aspects of cancer treatment and the well-being of the healthcare staff?
Well, we rely a lot on research, and research has shown that the staff at a cancer facility, they need convenience, like TJ mentioned, access, to the support spaces and to the patient. They need collaboration, so they need spaces to collaborate and get support from their fellow colleagues. And they also need a space for respite, a space to get away. So maybe a more private space where they can just get away and decompress for a few minutes. But we also just think of the locality, because every location is different. So we talk to the staff and, what are your needs? And kind of go from there. Some communities are more social and some are more private. And we try to keep that in mind in each location or wherever the facility is located.
I think one thing that I would add, and I think, Doug, you touched on it a little bit, when you have a patient at the end of their cancer journey that is in palliative care or hospice, or they have decided that treatment is no longer what they want to do, and now we've gone into an active dying process, or you're still interacting with the family, it's emotionally hard for the provider as well, because you're attached to that patient. I think the challenge becomes we learn as providers or clinicians to compartmentalize our emotions, because you don't want to like lose it in front of the patient,
right?
Because then that doesn't really instill faith. Like my provider is a mess, does that mean things are going bad for me? But it is, you do share moments with your patients, and that's okay. But you also may need to step away for a minute to just try to collect yourself, especially if it's, if you are relating to a congruency in your life. Like if my mom passed away and now I have another person of my age that has a mom, and that, like, you identify more with that, and that may be a little more challenging. So you might need a minute to walk into a break room and just look out the window, take a breath, and spend a couple minutes having a cup of coffee to collect yourself. And I think those things to emotionally support the staff are also really important so that they can continue to support the patient and families.
Yeah, I'm so glad you touched on that, because I was going to mention, I've heard one of our team members, Wendy St. John, talk about that. This is leading into a whole other discussion that I'm sure we can do. And I know you guys have presented on burnout, but it can contribute to that if you don't have those spaces. And to your point, it's the same as at work. If you start spending time with people and get to know them, you develop just general care for their well-being. And so when those moments happen, that's a really good point. Let's talk a little bit, Christy, about the patient experience. What are some of the unique emotional and physical needs of cancer patients that you've got to consider in facility design?
We have to remember above all that cancer patients are individuals and they have unique needs and unique habits. Providing some flexibility and control of the space, some variety. So when my dad was receiving chemo, he didn't like to be in a big room with other patients. He really wanted a quiet, intimate setting, but others thrive over knitting circles while they're getting chemo. They're showing up the same time every week or every few days. They're seeing the same people. And that support network is strong and needs to be celebrated. And so flexibility, variety of spaces, the ability to be comfortable and to move around, to have your family with you and for them to have a space to belong. That's really big. And, you know, we always try to make sure that there's a conversation during programming and planning. How many family members do you typically see? How will we accommodate larger groups if it is a, you know, a more challenging situation and there may be a few extra family members? How can we design a space that can flex or that we can accommodate a larger family? And then you dig a little deeper and you look at the facility design and you look at positive distractions. How can we provide access to daylight? How can we provide access to green space? Even if it's not walking into a garden, just being able to look at one is huge. Music, art, and then again, that control where the patient can turn it up or down or not have any, just silence. Even the basic fundamental, and we've talked about it before, but wayfinding. We should not make it harder for a patient ever along their journey from their car, from the point of entry into the parking lot, from their car to their clinic, and to make sure that we're walking that path with them and that we understand every step along the way and how one decision can impact whether it's creating more stress for the patient and family or really trying to alleviate that.
Those are really good points to make. And especially about that, you know, if, as we've all dealt with, you know, Doug has dealt with it himself. If you're in those spaces and you're lost, it's just more frustration.
Yeah.
So TJ, how do you balance clinical efficiency with creating that supportive and healing environment when you're trying to lay out and design these spaces?
Well, I think it's, Christy alluded to being with the patient every step of the way. And I would acclimate scenario testing to walk a mile in their shoes. You know, where am I parking? Where do I come in? What do I see when I first come in? I want to see something beautiful, or I want to see a piece of art, or I want something that distracts me from the fact that I'm coming to get treatment again. There was a center that I toured on one of the healthcare design conferences, and the first thing you walked into was this beautiful piece of like glass art of their community. And immediately when I walked in, I was like, oh, wow. Like that was the first thing I thought of. I didn't think of anything else. So just trying to make sure that we do those scenarios, that we walk in their shoes, and that we allow them a moment to take a breath. You'll hear people say just 3 seconds isn't going to make a difference. Just give it a minute. And really purposefully, Dr. Harris at Eskenazi Health would always say this about the art therapy program there, purposely place art to allow the patient to pause so that they can reflect. And then that does calm them down physiologically. So just being purposeful, efficiency, being aware of that, and then being aware of what they're seeing. Those things really work well together if they're parallel and you have that awareness. And I think, sure. I do think that's a strength of our firm, right? Like we have an awareness of both. And I think that does make our design and our environment very effective, very therapeutic. I mean, I think we've seen that with some of the POE and or some of the post-occupancy evaluation discussions that we've had from patients.
And Doug, I've not addressed you with a question for a minute, so I've got one here for you. Can you share an example of a design solution that made a significant impact on patient comfort or outcomes?
Well, TJ and Christy mentioned positive distractions and wayfinding. We'll try to, you know, provide that healing environment, you know, for the patient. And those infusion bays give them a view to the exterior and not only something quiet, but we found that they like activity. We have one facility where the cancer center was close to an interstate, and we not only provided view to a healing garden, but they had access to, they could see that interstate. They just liked that activity, seeing that activity. And I think it has something, you know, to do with movement and growth and kind of the journey. And let's say like a Mentor Accelerator will provide positive distractions. In another facility, we have like a starfield ceiling so that when they're laying on that table during treatment, you know, they have something distracting to look at. And then we provided images on the walls. They weren't just generic. They were images from the surrounding community. That's something that they could relate to. And I think they really appreciated that. Another example, when we think about wayfinding at one facility, we provided a fountain that had a stone surround and a stone wall on the exterior. So they saw that material when they first entered the facility. And that stone continued through the waiting area, the reception area, and the pathway back to the infusion and radiation oncology areas. And then within those, that stone wall was niches from a local, that had artwork from a local artist. And that stone wall became a real wayfinding element and something to give them the means to circulate through the space, and they kind of know where they are and it leads somewhere. There's a destination there. And we'll often, when we introduce artwork, you know, we'll use local artists. So they're familiar with the community and they really have something to offer in that respect.
That's fascinating. Thinking along that point, we've talked a lot about clinical care, but how do you design cancer centers to serve as a community resource beyond clinical care?
Well, it's really providing flexible spaces, and it has to do with the programs that the facility sponsors. It's providing spaces for that, whether it's yoga, whether it's education, but it's also allowing the community to come in. I know there's cancer centers where artists will come in and set up the easel and infusion bay and just paint, and they get to know the patients. There's a space for that, a communal space maybe in that infusion bay. Not only for the family, but for the patients, even if they want a more private space, you know, it's a long treatment. So they might come out into that family space or communal space. And so just providing those spaces is really important.
I think one thing I would say to add to that, to the like art therapy, music therapy program, and we talked about positive distraction, but it's something to look forward to when you go there, because you're already you already know that you have a diagnosis that could potentially be life altering or life ending. So, you know, I see the fountain in the stone wall, or I hear that sound and that makes me feel better. Or there's a music, so I get a, that's normal. I mean, Christy talked about normalcy. Just because you have a cancer diagnosis doesn't mean you can't do normal things.
Right.
And you gotta give them the control to do that. Like, I would be happy to sit and watch a painter paint while I was getting chemo, because maybe I wouldn't have to think about that. And maybe I could be creative. And that's healing. That's part of the mind-body wellness connection for healing. And I think those things, again, paralleled with some of that clinical care, is really powerful.
We're talking about how important these things are. Christy, what are the considerations that you make going in to make these facilities feel less institutional and more welcoming to families? We've talked a lot about how we try to do that, but what are some of your thoughts?
I think it's really all of this, but it does come down to providing comfort. and making sure that you talk through all of the different programs that are provided in the setting by the facility, and then also future cast, you know, where are the trends? One thing that was really important, and I never would have known that it was this big of a deal, but when my son was in clinic, I talked about how we'd be there frequently, and I had my twins in their stroller, but what got us through those hours sitting there were the therapy dogs and having a place for my children to play with the dogs. And it's not that you design a space and you program it and you program in a therapy dog play area, but making sure that you have corridors or you have a combination of rooms that can open up to allow all these extras to happen in the space with, like, talk about when I would go to treatment with my dad, or when I'm looking at designing an infusion area, making sure that we're looking at the creature comforts. You know, is there a TV? Where is the TV? How can it be right at the patient, but still share it with the family members? You walk through all of the details. Where is that nourishment station? And are we providing a small refrigerator and ice machine so families can go and they can feel at home and they can feel involved in the care of the patient? And so each step that we can take and each question that we ask are to really break down the barrier of care and the line, if you can, break down the line between that clinical care and the family caregiver and wrap it all around the patient to really increase the experience for everybody. And it helps the staff as well. I mean, we've talked about how the staff get to know everybody, and they totally do. They can't leave everything packaged up neatly, emotionally in a box on the shelf. I mean, it comes out. And by seeing the patients and by seeing the family thrive in the space where they're working, it's beneficial to everybody. And so making sure that we look at where we're providing the art or how we're dividing the infusion spaces, making sure that it's oriented in a place convenient or in a way that's convenient for the staff to give care, but also so that if there's art or beautiful glass or whatever, that it gives back to the staff and the patients.
Yeah. And I love that answer. And one thing that we haven't really touched on yet is how do cultural and demographic factors influence your design decisions? And I'll start with Doug.
Well, we involve the community. It's really about communication and get them involved early on in the process. We'll have advisory groups, and they can inform us on the design. One example is one facility we had the infusion bays. It was almost completely all just an open area. They were very social, and that was very important to them. And then we have the other facilities that this has all private infusion bays. But that really comes down to the community and those advisor groups and second guessing, but really getting information from them as well as the staff. The staff, you know, knows their patient population pretty well, and they have a lot of input as well.
And then, Christy, I'm guessing you have something to add based on all of your experience, not just on our side of the table, but as you've mentioned several times, going through it yourself. So
I think it's incredibly important to understand the value system of the community, understand the stories and what makes people feel like they belong in their community, and to bring that in. I have had the good fortune, and not on an oncology facility, but the good fortune to work with a Native American tribe, and their stories, their creation or how they came to have fire and how the earth was formed. By bringing those stories and local artwork, local photographs by local artists, bringing all of that into the facility meant a lot to them, because that's how they felt like they belonged. And that was part of the way the community, even though they weren't inside the facility with the patient, but the way that community could really reach out and embrace and provide support. And so that would be the biggest thing. And it comes from collaboration with groups, collaboration with a parent, with a patient family advisory board, bringing those into the conversation and really letting
them. Yeah, the collaboration seems really, really key. Well, if you, I know you all follow the show, of course, but for our listeners that do, you all know I love talking about innovation in the future. So let's go around the room for a final question. I'd like each of you to share either an emerging trend from a design perspective that you're seeing, or what you think oncology facilities will look like in 10 years and beyond? And Doug, we'll start with you.
Well, we'd all love to see a cure for cancer and not have a need for treatment centers. But for the next 10 years, you know, I think really like home health and survivorship is increasing. I know from my own experience, you have not only the stress of the disease and the treatment, but all the coordination of the different doctors you have, the pharmacy coordinating all the medicines, and they don't always get it right, you know, and even going to get your medicine and that kind of thing. So, and I've experienced home health during COVID between my cancer surgeries, and it was just critical. It was so nice to have that provider, that, you know, nurse come in and help with things that were needed. So I think that's important. And there's, you know, innovations with wearable devices and remote monitors. So some of those diagnostic things could be more at home or be more convenient so that you're not having to go to the facility and take the time and to do that. But so I also think we're seeing, you know, less side effects with the treatment. And I'm reading articles all the time where they're coming up with medicine that has less side effects. And
good point.
Even some oral medicines that replaces surgery and that sort of thing. So, you know, hopefully we'll see less need for that. But in the next 10 years, we're still likely to see the need for the treatment centers. It's interesting that some of the innovation, like of Linacs, the combination of modalities like CT Linac and MR Linac, and we're starting to see some self-shielded modalities, so that will maybe loosen up some of the requirements where I mentioned that Linacs and that radiation therapy is usually on the ground floor. Sometimes that means that it's separated from the infusion center in a large facility. And so that would give the capability of grouping those departments together into the cancer center. So that would be great.
Really, really interesting insights there. I appreciate that. Christy, how about you?
I'd love to say prevention and we don't have to deal with it anymore, but that would be echoing Doug's, so I'm sure everybody's perspective. I think that we're going to see more and more decentralized care. We're going to see highly specialized developments, more technology developments that will be concentrated on the larger campuses. And then we're going to have more and more distribution. As population grows, we're going to see more and more satellite facilities popping up. And then we have to all figure out what AI is going to do to the future of cancer care. And I would see that enabling more at-home services and earlier detection and bespoke care and customized treatment programs. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. I want to highlight when you said AI might be able to help with earlier detection. I think it's important. I'm sure most of the people that are listening to this know, but as I've read, the earlier you can detect, the better your chances are. So that can play a huge role. TJ, last but not least, you have the floor.
I think that Doug and Christy have great expertise about, and I echo everything that they've just brought up. I think the one thing I would say is, I was sitting here trying to think of what did patients ask me to do for them in the rooms, and or if they're sitting there. And it's really I think it's attention to small things such as lighting, maybe sound, what does it smell like, and really making that environment, giving them that control. I think, you know, I think there are some things that are going to change. There are some things that aren't going to change in healthcare. You know, 10 years ago, we said nobody was going to be in a hospital. Well, the hospital is still full, and here we are. So I think we have to plan for both. So how do we improve what we're doing and allow them to have control and to really make it individualized? So when you're designing a therapy bay or something, you know, like what lighting options do I have? What sound options do I have? Like, I don't want to hear sound. I'm very sensitive to sound. Right. So light when I'm going to sleep. So yes, I want to see outside, but if I have a brain tumor, that is going to cause more pain. So I want to be able to accommodate more than one type of patient in that room. So just thinking through those details as a designer and as a planning, I think, firm with those scenarios we talked about shouldn't go unnoticed. It's not, those little things do make a difference. And just remembering that when we're designing for humans.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining me. I think it's a challenging conversation at times because it does, as we've discussed, hit so close to home. But your insights and your leadership on this are greatly appreciated. So thank you guys so much for joining.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
I'd like to thank Doug, Christy, and Terry for joining me again on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you are interested in learning more about BSA and our expertise, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. And be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And we've got more content and project stories to share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.